the heart of it.
Roy West kicking in towards the centre. Roy Clark!
A distinctly Tasmanian conversation.
I can feel what it will be like when Tassie plays his first game, and I just...
towards half forward, Stewart flying over the top. Oh, pulled in a beautiful pass.
Well done from Scott. After all, Stewart has got the first goal. Has it gone?
Nichols has had the big ruck with it. Oh! Croswell!
Hello, this is The Heart of It, a distinctly Tasmanian conversation. In modern football, if a key forward kicks a bag of five goals on the weekend, their performance is widely celebrated. But there was a time when kicking five was routine, even average for some. Well, Peter Hudson at least. Hudson's record of 727 goals in only 129 VFL games at an average of 5.64 will never be surpassed. 16 in one game against Melbourne in 1969, a record equalling 150 in a season in 1971 when he was crudely knocked out in a winning grand final and can't remember the game. The king of the flat punt was a force to be reckoned with. In this episode, Peter Hudson reflects on his upbringing, the family home that backed onto the Boyer Oval at New Norfolk, his father Bob's protective instincts as the pair played in a senior premiership together when young Peter was only 15, the influence of legendary Tasmanian player and coach Trevor Leo, who honed Hudson's goal-kicking technique, helicopter rides to Waverley, and 200 goals in a season for Glenorchy. This is Peter Hudson's Tasmanian story.
We grew up in New Norfolk. My dad worked at what was called the Australian Newsprint Mills, where he worked for the whole of his working life. And I can remember clearly that I would spend countless hours on the Boyer Oval at New Norfolk kicking the footy. And in those days, of course, it was towards the end of the career of the great John Coleman. So every time I went to the Oval, I'd have to round up a couple of mates to kick the ball backwards and forwards, and I was John Coleman as far as I was concerned. And that went on for hours and hours and hours, and even to the stage where Mum would come out. Our back fence was the fence of the football oval. So Mum would come out to the back door of the house and yell out when it was time to go home for tea. So that was in the summer, of course, it became cricket. And so I played footy in the winter and cricket in the summer, and that went on for years. And so to say you grew up with a football in your hands is pretty close to the truth. And the other thing was that my dad, he played with New Norfolk in the senior competition. Then he went off and coached a number of the teams around the New Norfolk area. None of them exist anymore, but he was a very good footballer. And then at 15 years of age, I went off and played with a team called Upperdoon. Dad was the captain and coach, and I was the 15-year-old full forward, and we played together in that side, and we won the premiership.
Wow.
We beat a team called Medina. And once again, that team doesn't exist anymore, but it was a terrific way to grow up, because New Norfolk's a beautiful town, and all the facilities, we had the football oval, as I say, at the back of our house, right at the back of our house, and then 100 metres down the road was the tennis courts, and if I'd had time, another 100 metres, I would have been at the rowing sheds, but I never ever rowed because I never had time. But yeah, it was a wonderful way to grow up, and as I said before, New Norfolk is a beautiful town.
So your backyard is the Boyer Oval. You're there every day in winter kicking a football. Can you describe the setting, the type of ball you were using, even the earliest footy boots that you can remember wearing, stuff like that?
Oh, crikey. The boots, I think, might have even been a Jenkin boot. And the footy... It depended on how old the football was, but you still kicked it anyway. So it was a footy. And somehow or other, we managed to have football most of the time. So, but the biggest problem for me was finding mates that I could have a kick with. But someone always turned up, and I can remember occasions where I'd been on the Boyer Oval. It seemed like for 4 or 5 hours, and I can remember where there was a tap, and you can rehydrate. And I can remember saying, well, okay, I've been down here for 4 hours and it's probably time to go home. So I'd go home and someone had come round, a mate had come round, back down we'd go. And the only thing that stopped us was when it got dark, because it was very hard. In those days, you didn't have lights on football grounds. And so the darkness was about the only thing that that stopped me.
For those of my era who don't really know what a Jenkin boot is, can you describe it?
Oh, yeah, they were leather stops that, you know, were nailed into the boot. And that's the way it was in those days. But when they fell out, it was a bit awkward because they could fall out, and it was a bit awkward because you'd be a bit lopsided with stops missing off the boots.
Playing with your dad at the age of 15, you're the full forward. I'd imagine there were some pretty strong country types you were playing against in that era. Were you looked after by your teammates at times?
Yeah, well, I was looked after by my dad. He was the ruckman, and I can remember in the grand final, Dad played most of the game in the forward pocket, and I was at full forward, and I think he might have been there for a bit of protection, to be honest, when I look back on it. But it was a tremendous thrill to play with him, and because he played for a long, long time. Like I reckon he was still playing when he was about 38 or 37, 38. And he was a really good player. But as the years went by, and it still happened, my dad died a few years ago, and each year, I think I've found when I look back, I appreciate more every year that I was able to play with my dad, because not too many people do that. Mm. And, you know, particularly to win a premiership in what was a pretty good competition, because a lot of the players that played in a competition like that were ex-TFL, Tasmanian Football League players, that playing at the highest level. So it was a pretty good test. But I used to play of a morning with the school, the high school, New Norfolk High School. I'd play in the morning and then up and down in the afternoon. And then I look back now, and when Paul, my son, he went to Hutchins School in Hobart, he'd play with Hutchins in the morning and he played with Hobart in the afternoon. And I was coaching Hobart, and he did the same thing. And then, of course, both of us went on to play in a premiership side with the Hawthorn Football Club, exactly 20 years apart. And when you think of that, that's pretty unique.
So you got knocked out in 1971 by Kevin Neill early in the game. And of course you were looking to break Bob Pratt's record in
yes.
that game, and you ended up tying Bob Pratt
yeah.
at 150. Barry Lawrence
yeah.
smothers you on the mark. But you don't really remember any of that grand final, do you? Because you were knocked out. And yeah. I know you felt strongly when Paul won a grand final in 1991. It was almost your grand final
yes.
as well.
It was almost like I played the grand final through him. It was the eeriest. I still, even at this stage of my life, 50 years down the track, it's still eerie to think that I played in a grand final and I can't remember it. And the one thing I remember for the whole day was in the rooms at half time, I had my ear cut, split, you know, when I got hit, and it was being sewn up. And I'm on a bench there, and Robert Day was on the bench next to me. He'd been knocked out. And the one thing I can remember, and I don't know why I can remember this, I can remember them saying that we'd both been knocked out, and they were looking at basically the one that was the worst had to come off and the other one had to go back out, because we would have only had 17 men if we'd both gone off. And that was pre-concussion days. And anyway, I can remember them saying to Robert, are you okay? And he said, yeah, which way are we kicking? So he wasn't too good at all. But that's all I can remember for the whole day. So
unbelievable, really. So in terms of breaking the record, do you remember the build-up and the pressure associated with that? Did you feel like that was something that you really wanted to achieve?
I did, because what happened in the week leading up to the grand final, and a grand final is enough pressure without any side issues. And I am in a grand final, first time, and I'm three goals off equaling Bob Pratt's record and four goals off breaking it. And that year I'd averaged about seven goals a game. So without being egotistical, you think you're a chance.
Yeah.
You're not a lay-down Mazzia, but you might be a chance. And the media had Bob Pratt almost beside me for the whole week, and building up stories, building up the whole thing for the grand final. My main thought, like everybody else's, when you played under John Kennedy, this is the way you thought, was to win the grand final. That was the most important thing. And if I could have kicked six or seven goals, that would probably go a long way towards winning it. And so that was the build-up. But, you know, the funny part was that after the game, I thought about it, and I thought, okay, I didn't have a good grand final because I can't remember it, but I got three goals and I equaled the record. Now, had I got four goals, when I look back on it, it would have been a little bit false because he played less games than I did. And I went to his funeral, to Bob Pratt's funeral, and it hit me like a lightning bolt that I was glad I didn't break his record, because he went to his grave holding the record, and I had the great fortune to share it with him. So, and we won the game, and that was the most important thing.
Your kicking style, Pete, is unique, and I know that there's a Trevor Leo component to your goal-kicking routine that I'll ask you about, but who first taught you to kick a football? Do you remember being taught to kick a ball? Is it something you just did organically and found your own way?
Yeah, well, I kicked a flat punt for starters, and no one kicks a flat punt. And the reason I kicked the flat punt is, in golfing terms, the sweet spot on a football has got to be more on the bottom of the ball than the end of the ball, just by the shape of it. And I just grew up kicking, I suppose in those days, you kick drop kicks or torps. And I think what happened with me was I developed this flat punt, not that I was the only person that ever kicked it, but you had a little bit of a margin for error. In other words, if you kicked a little bit on the left side of the ball, it could do a reverse swing like in cricket. If you kicked it a little bit on the outside, it could, but you kick a drop punt, if you don't kick it exactly right, it's not going to come back. You know, you're not going to. And I've had many a memory of the goal umpire, because the flat punt used to wobble all over the place, and the goal umpire sort of backwards and forwards. I don't know. At times, I'm not sure how they judged it to be a goal or a point, because it was. And I kicked one at Moorabbin one day, and went through the goals, and blew out through the points. And the St Kilda players going up the ground with the ball, and the goal umpire standing there like, he was the only one. Everyone else thought it was just.
So did anyone ever try and dissuade you from that method of kicking?
No. Now, what happened, I think because I had, they say practice makes perfect. Well, I'm not saying I was perfect, but I practiced a lot. And I think just without even thinking about it, it was just like a reflex action. I would kick the flat punt, and it worked for me. And then there was a carnival in Hobart in 1966, and I played in that carnival, and I was missing a few. I kicked 20 goals 20 in the carnival. Now, I'd never had 20 goals 20 before that, and thank heavens I'd never had it after that. But it was just like a bit of a horror patch, Trevor Leo was the coach, and one night I can remember we were training because you played every second day in those carnivals. And we were having a bit of a training run on our off day. And he took me out onto North Hobart Oval. And he said, "Yeah, think about this." And he sort of came up with a set of rules. And I've lived by those rules ever since. I've done quite a bit of coaching over the years, goal kicking coaching. And it's a very simple set of rules where everything's done in a straight line. And he showed me that one night on North Hobart Oval, and it corrected whatever I was doing that was wrong. And I've never forgotten that.
Do you remember exactly what the rules were?
Oh, yeah. You've got to get the ball. That's very important. So you've got the ball, then you're going to aim for goal, and you pick out something behind the goals, which is your target. You don't pick out the lady in the pink cardigan because she might get up and move. So you say it's an upright in the grandstand. That's your target. You balance yourself up, and I think that's very important because that's like pushing the starter button. And you run towards your target. But when you run towards your target, you have got the ball, I say, in the vice. There's an imaginary vice in line with your right leg or your left leg if you're a left footer. Don't line it up with your left leg if you're a right footer because you could miss it. So you've lined it up in the vice, you run off towards your target, and you've got the ball in the vice. It can't move, so you can imagine how frustrated I get when blokes are running in, flicking the ball around their fingers. So you run off towards your target, watching the target, you've got the ball in the vice, you know exactly where that is. You run for whatever number of steps suit you, but to me, 6 or 7 steps, watching the target. Then you look down to make sure the ball gets from the vice to your foot straight. And then all that, because it's in a straight line, the ball should go straight. A couple of players that I've been involved with over the years that were having a bit of trouble with their goal kick, and we've talked about that system, the Trevor Leo system, I call it, and a couple of them have gone from pretty unreliable kicks to very reliable kicks.
So you start playing senior football at 15 with Upper Derwent. Talk me through your transition from that phase into the next phase and onto the VFL with Hawthorn. How does that all take place?
Well, at 15 years of age, 16 years of age, because I started playing with New Norfolk in the TFL when I was 16, you take it all a bit in your stride. You know, it's just an everyday occurrence in a way. And it's not till you look back that you really think about it, that to go from Upper Derwent in country footy in Tasmania to the TFL was a big step. And then to be in a situation where you're sought by clubs to play with them in the VFL, that was a big thing. And not many Tasmanians did it because of the fact that it wasn't as easy back in the, say, the 50s and 60s to make the move to Melbourne. It was a big thing to make a move to Melbourne in those days. A lot of players, Trevor Leo included, never ever made the move because they had a good job and they had a home, a family and all that sort of stuff. So when they used to pick a Tasmanian side in the 50s and 60s, they were good sides. And it was because all those good players were playing in Tasmania and not in Victoria. And then I know Percy Jones and I came at the same time. He went to Carlton, I go to Hawthorn. And prior to that, you could almost count on two hands the number of players that had made that move. You know, you had your Royce Harts and your Verdon Howes and people like that. But then after that, it seemed like after that time when Percy and I went to the VFL, there started to be more and more and more. And then at one stage, there were about 40 Tasmanians running around in the AFL, or the VFL, it was probably then, VFL to AFL.
Do you remember the advances that were made to you, the way clubs approached you and how they tried to get you to move across Bass Strait?
Yes, because in those days, what happened in the carnival, this carnival I was talking about in 1966, I got All Australian along with Graham Lee, Gypsy Lee, and I got All Australian, which was unheard of for two Tasmanians to get All Australian, because I won the goal kicking with 20 goals 20, and so I became a bit of a target for some of the clubs. Now, when I say some of the clubs, I think it was 10 out of the 12, and the two that didn't come to see me, one was Collingwood because they had Peter McKenna, the other one was Geelong because they had Doug Wade. But just about every other side did, but that's the way it was. And every club would have loved to have got Polly Farmer from Western Australia, but somehow or other Geelong got him. But that was the way it was in those days.
Are there any interactions at that time that stand out with the 10 clubs that did approach you and their methods to try and woo you, or were they talking to you? Were they talking to your mum and dad?
Oh, yeah, both. Yeah, they both. I nearly went to South Melbourne because Bobby Skelton was there, and I nearly went there, but my dad, to his absolute credit, said, look, just hold off for a while and just take your time. And then Hawthorn came on the scene, and there was something, I almost went to Essendon as well. So I weighed up all the clubs, and whilst Essendon were one of the standout sides, I thought that they had quite a few players that were probably coming towards the end of their careers. And when I went to Hawthorn, there was like a light bulb effect. I saw all these young guys, like Peter Crimmins, Des Maher, Bob Keddie, Ray Wilson, and on it went. And I thought, gee, they're young, and I think there could be a chance there a few years down the track. Well, I went there in 1967, we won the premiership in 71. So I think I wasn't far off the mark. It was funny because all the sides had a different approach to it, but by the time it got really on in earnest, I'd pretty much made up my mind that I was going to go to Hawthorn. And yeah, I'm so glad I did.
I think that worked out very well for you.
Yeah.
You talk about guys like Trevor Leo in that era when 58, when Tassie beats Western Australia and South Australia in 1960, Tassie beats Victoria at York Park in that famous win, and there are so many great players still in Tasmania, representing Tasmania. What about your own opportunities to represent Tasmania and pull on the map? Records are hard to totally calculate the number of times. Do you remember how many times you would have played for Tassie, and do you have any fond memories that stick out there?
Well, the carnival was sensational, and it was a bit overwhelming because you don't play in a carnival like every year, and I can remember it was a real thrill, but then there was the anxiety because you're playing against the best players in the country and the best fullbacks. So I can remember the carnival very well. I can remember playing South Australia down in Hobart. It was a situation where, yep, okay, you've played those games. And then I was off to the VFL. So then I played for Victoria. And that was a thrill. You know, regardless of whether you loved or hated the Big V, it was pretty much an ambition of most players to play for the Big V. You know, that's the way it was. So then you finish up playing against Tasmania, and then I played in the carnival in Adelaide for Victoria against Tasmania. So it was all that sort of, but it wasn't like you were a traitor, because that's the way it was. You didn't play for your state of origin, you played for the state that you were playing in at the time.
What memories do you have of those great Tasmanian footballers you played with during that era? And even the 1960 game, do you remember that as a young fellow, the significance of Tassie knocking off Victoria at York Park?
Oh, yeah, I do. And that was a red-letter day for Tasmania. There was no doubt about that. And it was almost unheard of. And then I was thrilled when Paul played for Tasmania against Victoria in a State of Origin game, and they knocked Victoria off. So, yeah, you can imagine what a thrill that was.
Would you have listened to the 1960 game on the radio? There wouldn't have been any television coverage.
No, radio, yeah. Radio was the only way, yeah.
Who were your heroes, Tasmanian football heroes, during that era as a young Peter Hudson?
There were two players that I thought were just sensational playing for Tasmania. One was Darryl Baldock, and the other one was John Leedham. And they were such good players. I can remember as a kid watching them at North Hobart. They were so good that they could interchange. You know, Darryl Baldock could go to centre-half back and hold his own against anybody, and John Leedham could go to centre-half forward or vice versa. And they were just standout players. But the whole side was good in those days, because, as I said before, you didn't have that mass exodus of players from Tasmania to Victoria in those days. So the only thing we seemed to struggle in was when sides had the big ruckman against us. We had a terrific player in Hobart, Jeff Whitten, but Jeff was giving these ruckmen. Western Australia always had big ruckmen. South Australia always had big ruckmen. And Jeff seemed to be giving them like about a foot start. And Percy came along, Percy Jones, but he was only my age. We're only kids. And so he couldn't, you know, he was always going to battle to ruck against those experienced players. Like Polly Farmer, for example. They seemed so big, they seemed giants. But everywhere else around the ground, we more than held our own.
It's interesting that you, when you talk about great Tasmanian footballers, Baldock, very widely recognised, obviously came over to Victoria and achieved what he achieved here. John Leedham didn't ever come to Victoria, but you talk about him in a similar light. So he was that good a footballer.
Like, to me, there was only a cigarette paper between him and Darryl.
Wow.
But that's only my opinion. I know a lot of people agree with me. He was one of those sort of... He probably the player that I've seen in my lifetime that was very much like him was Greg Williams. They always seemed to be able to get the ball, A. B, they always seemed to have so much time to do whatever they wanted to do. And that's what he was like. And I would say that he would have been able to do anything he wanted to do in the VFL if he'd made the move. But mind you, Trevelio, Bernie Payne, you just go on and on. Murray Steele, Max Griffiths, all those players, they would have been fantastic players in the VFL in those days if they'd made the move.
And you ultimately go back. So tell me the story. You've established yourself as an absolute star of the VFL competition. People go to games just to watch you. Kids at Glen Ferry go from one end of the ground to the other, depending on which way Hawthorne's kicking. Tell me the story of how you arrived back in Tasmania.
Well, I damaged my knee in the first half of the first game of 1972, and I did a real good number on it, and I was in hospital, straight to the hospital. And at that stage, I had Paul, who was only a baby, and Steph and myself, and I had to think about the future for my family. And I had what I call, refer to as a fairy godfather. You know, not you hear about fairy godmothers, but this guy was like a godfather to me. Bob Arthur in Tasmania. He built the Carlisle Hotel, which was the hotel. Then he built the Granada Hotel. And when I damaged my knee, he got in touch with me because he and I had a discussion a few years before that. What would you want to do after your football? And I said... And that was the time where every second footballer seemed to get into a hotel. And I said to him, I'd love to get into my own business, into the hotel. So when I did Manee, I got this phone call from Bob Arthur. Are you still interested in the hotel? I said, yes, certainly. And like, I genuinely, honestly didn't know whether I'd ever be able to play football again. And I couldn't take the risk. I had to take the opportunity to go into the hotel business with Bob. And it was financially the best thing ever. I was always going to miss my football, but I didn't know whether I'd ever be capable of playing again. And the rest is history. I spent 3.5 years getting over the knee injury, playing a bit in Tassie, having one game in 1973, and then eventually I played the whole season in 1977. But to be able to play that season, I had to fly in from Hobart every weekend, every Friday afternoon. And I'd check into my second home of those days. It was the California Motel in Hawthorne. And I'd be back in the hotel on Saturday nights. And I did that for the whole year. And but the move was made, I'd say, purely on the fact that I could see a future for myself and my family by going back when I did my knee.
You had huge events at the Granada as well, didn't you? You had very famous Australian acts performed there. Yeah. Can you list a few for us?
Oh, yeah. Well, the one game I played in 1973, there's a story around that.
This is the helicopter game?
Yeah, the helicopter game. Which is funny when you look back on it, to think that you're associated with a thing called the helicopter game. And what happened there was that Hawthorn was struggling. They weren't kicking a lot of goals to make the final four. It was final four in those days. And I got a call from John Kennedy to say, would you be interested in having a go? This is about the third last game of the year. It was going to be Sydney or the Bush sort of thing. If Hawthorn kept winning, they could make the four, the final four. If they didn't, they're out. And he said to me, would you be interested in making a comeback? And I said, oh, John, I said, a bit of a problem. I said, I've done nothing. No training, nothing, for not just about 2 full years. And he said, oh, I'll come down and see how you are. So he flew down to Hobart, and we went to a school ground, Rosetta High School ground, and I ran from one end to the other, and I was blowing like a draft horse. And he said to me, oh, he said, a bit worse than I thought. So he said, what we'll do, if it's all right, he said, if you're happy to do this, give it a couple of weeks of training, and then we'll see how you are. And anyway, I did the 2 weeks of training, and it was decided I would play, I'd have a go. So to get to Melbourne, they were going to book me over on a Friday afternoon, play in the game, and then fly me back Saturday night. And getting back to what you were saying about the acts that we had at the hotel, because we had the biggest room for cabaret entertainment in Tasmania at the Granada Tavern. And they said, we'll fly over Friday. I said, look, I can't come. And they said, why? I said, I've got Norman Gunston appearing at my hotel. And they said, oh, right. Right, but this is what we'll do. We'll fly you over Saturday morning, and to be sure of getting you from Tullamarine to Waverley, we'll get a helicopter. So Steph and I flew over, we jumped in the helicopter, and I can remember they had a bit of lunch for us, and it was quiche. And so we're flying across Melbourne eating this quiche, and we had to land at the what is now the police academy, and it used to be a seminary for I'm sure that's what it's called, for priests.
Yes, yeah.
And anyway, we landed on their front lawn, and they had a car there to take me across to Waverley, just which was only a short trip. And then after the game, back into the helicopter and back to Hobart. And so we had Norman Gunston appearing, but we used to have all sorts of acts there. You know, one of my favourites was Little River Band, because when the bands came to Tassie, they would appear at our pub because, once again, it was the size of the room.
So you went back to Hawthorn in 1977, then you came back to Tassie again and you play at Glenorchy.
Yeah.
1979, you kicked 200 goals in a season. Yeah. Unbelievable feat. And you kick your 200th in the grand final, one of the most famous grand finals in Tassie footy history.
Yeah, yeah.
Tony Chadwick kicking that late goal for Clarence and a three-point win. I've seen the footage of you kicking your 200th goal, and these days you have a flood of, you know, we saw with Buddy Franklin when you kicked 1,000, they're all on the field. It happened when you kicked your 100th, and for you and your VFL career as well, they all ran out. I think an old lady comes out and quietly says something to you. Can you remember that moment in the 79 grand final?
Yeah, look, I can't, but I know vaguely what you're talking about. But it was, it's pretty, it's daunting when people come from all directions. And the one that I'll never forget with that was in 1968, I kicked 100. And John Kennedy said, and people associated with Hawthorn know this story pretty well, he said, I needed four, and we're playing Collingwood, and there were 30-odd thousand people at Glenferrie Oval, which people don't believe. How could you fit 30-odd thousand in there? And John Kennedy said, if he gets the four goals he needs for the 100, I don't want anyone to go near him. And that was because he wanted to get on with the game and win the game. And there's footage of Graham Arthur running past me, because Graham, as far as Hawthorn was concerned, could walk on water. And he ran past me and just tapped me on the backside as he went past. And that's all there was. So the next year, 1969, I kicked 100. And that was the first time the crowd ever jumped the fence. And I got the shock of my life, because they were coming flat out. And I'll never forget it, because the trainers were smart enough to get out there really quickly. And the police, and that the main policeman on the day was Brian Crimmins, Peter's father. And because he was in charge of all the Hawthorn police area. And he got out there, so they got around me, and so there was no damage done. But they came from everywhere. And then that was the first time that had ever happened. And then from then on, like I kicked 170 and then another one, 71, and then 77, and you just knew they were going to be coming.
How special then to kick 200 goals? I mean, 100 goals in a season is this monumental milestone. Yeah. You kicked 200 in a very good competition.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, it was terrific, but we had a great side. Like, the years I played at Glenorchy, because when I went back, everyone thought I'd go back to New Norfolk, but I had my hotel in the Glenorchy suburb, and it just didn't make sense that I couldn't really play with New Norfolk and have a hotel in Glenorchy. So I played with Glenorchy. I coached them and then played with them. But it was a thrill to kick 200. There's no doubt about that. But in Tassie, as you would know, being from Tasmania, it gets very confusing, because you've got home and away games, you've got finals, you've got intrastate games, you've got interstate games, and you lose count when you're playing all those different, and you're not sure which goals are part of your tally for the year.
So that day, did you know when you kicked your 200 that you'd kicked your 200?
Yeah, only because it was built up for the day, you know. So, but the funny part about it is that you played everybody, most teams, four times, because there are only six teams in the comp. And I played against Hobart, and Peter Gray was their full back. And most of the time, if not all of the time, I played on Peter. And in the four games, I kicked 54 goals against Hobart in four games. And Peter, who's the loveliest guy, he's a really nice guy. He's still a publican down there. He's made more of it than I did. You know, he's sort of had a lot of fun with that.
That he helped you get there.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that was funny because one day I kicked 18 and got two votes.
Who got the three?
Danny Ling.
Played well.
Yeah, and it's been a laughing point ever since. And Danny has more fun with it than anyone because he reckons he was. The story I heard was that he was sitting having his lunch on the Sunday watching World of Sport, which we all used to watch in those days, and Adrian Bowden, who played with Melbourne, and he gave the votes. And he gave Danny thought he was a good chance for two votes. He said that I'd get the three for 18. Anyway, he read out the votes and he said, three votes, Danny Ling. And Danny said he nearly dropped his lunch on the floor. He got such a shock. And I said to people after that, yeah, because everyone was onto it. And I said, well, it's pretty simple. I said, if you could kick 27, you'd be a fair chance for three votes.
Based on that, Mats, I could honestly talk to you for hours about your footy career, Pete, but I want to get your impressions on the future of Tassie footy and that announcement that came through that Tassie will have licences in the men's and women's competitions. Firstly, what was your reaction when you, I'm sure you watched the press conference in the afternoon, and did you have a tear in the eye? Did it bring up some emotions? How did it make you feel?
Oh, look, I was thrilled to bits with the announcement. I thought it was, it had been talked about for so long, how Tassie deserved to have a team. And nobody could dispute that, like, and nobody does. But there seemed to be lots and lots of hurdles along the journey. And I'm talking nearly 30 years ago when I chaired the original task force to try and get a game in Tasmania when Jim Bacon was the Premier, and what a battle we had just to get one game down there. And then we got two games, and then there was four games, and then North Melbourne go down there. So all that happened, but all along it was always talked about in terms of Tasmania deserves to have a team. Particularly when the Gold Coast and Greater Western Sydney came along. And I can understand, and I don't know that everybody agrees with this, but I can understand why they have Greater Western Sydney and Gold Coast, because already you've got the local derby up there, or derby, or whatever you want to call it, in Queensland and New South Wales. And I can understand that, but there's still always that argument, yeah, okay, well, but Tassie deserves a team. And I think with all that water that's gone under the bridge, and what a battle we had to just get one game 25, 30 years ago, all built up to what it is now, you know, where Tassie is going to get its team. And I think that was the thrill of it all. And I just thought when the announcement was made that that was as good as it gets. And then we've got all the talk about the stadium, we've got all the talk about the people protesting about it down there, but that's all, to me, a different situation altogether to the fact that, as far as I'm concerned, we've got our team and we will have a stadium. That's all there is to it. And the rest of it, as far as I'm concerned, it's just got to be taken care of. On the day before the announcement, I did an interview and I was asked, what did I think? Like, this was an interview that was done on the basis that within 24 hours the announcement was going to be made, that it was all going to happen. And I said this, and I wasn't being a smarty at all. I said, you've asked me what I think, I don't think anything. The reason I don't think anything, with the greatest of respect, is it's done. The time for thinking's over. The time for getting on with it is now. And that's the way I see it.
And this is the chance, isn't it? This is the chance to be part of something special. Yeah. That long-held dream. And, you know, Tassie's got the four legends in the Hall of Fame, of which you're one of them, and Royce Hart and Ian Stewart and Darryl Baldock, the late, great Darryl Baldock as well. So the contribution to the game is there. The legacy's there. And now the last pieces, we're on the cusp of seeing that materialise. How will you feel when that team runs out and plays a game? Or when those teams, men's and women's teams now?
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing, you know, the AFLW. I mean, that's part of everything these days, an important part of everything these days. And we'll have our AFLW team in Tasmania that will be playing at the highest possible level. I know when they run out, I know I'll immediately think back to when I played in the under-13s, when Robin Hood was my coach, and... you know, that'll all flood back to me, and I'd say it will flood back to everyone. And when I've spoken to the likes of Rodney Ead or Jack Riewoldt, I'm pretty sure we're all exactly on the same wavelength with it. And it will be a thrill, but I think it'll be even a bigger thrill because of the tough time that we have had to go through to get this to this stage. And the other thing that you and I've talked about is I believe that football, every bit of football in Tasmania has got a benefit from it. Junior football, whatever football's there has got a benefit from it. And if it doesn't, then I don't think we've succeeded as we should.
Pete, awesome chatting to you. Just a couple of quick fire questions for you just to round this out.
Mm.
And your views will be very interesting here because your name's cropped up in a few answers when I've asked these questions to other people. Greatest Tasmanian footballer of all time, in your opinion?
I would say Darryl Baldock, but very closely followed by, like, you know, we've talked about John Leedham. I'm in awe of what a lot of Tasmanians have done. Like Alistair Lynch. Like, Steph and I treat Alistair like almost like a second son because he played under me at Hobart. He worked at the hotel when he came down from Wynyard. You know, his career has been amazing. I have the utmost respect for Rodney Ead. They're all great players, all really good players. But if you had to pick one, it'd be hard to go past Darryl Baldock.
All right, now, a Tasmanian, any Tasmanian you can pick, has ever played the game, has marked in your team, and the siren sounds, and you need a goal to win the game. Who is the Tasmanian you would have taking the shot for goal?
I'll answer this in a way that I hope sounds a little bit humorous, but my son Paul. He's a beautiful kick, his career has been sensational. Like, he's played nearly 250 games and kicked just on 500 goals as a half forward flanker. Yeah. And he, you know, when he went to the Bulldogs, which broke our heart, but we were pleased for him. You know, we thought at the time he made the right decision to go. He's won their goal kicking from a half forward flank 2 years out of 4 years he was there. But he was a beautiful kick. On both feet, when kicking both with both sides of your body was not all that common when he was playing. I'd have him. I'd back him in.
All right. The few words that pop into your head when you think of a Tasmanian footballer, what sums up a Tasmanian footballer?
I think the determination to succeed, and lots of times against the odds, but the other thing is that I think that Tasmanians have done so well in the VFL, AFL, because of the conditions they play under in Tasmania, which are so similar to Victoria. And I think that always gave Tasmanians a real head start over a lot of other people, particularly from Western Australia or South Australia. The surfaces were probably a lot different, and the condition, the weather and all that sort of stuff was probably a lot different to Victoria. But I think the thing about Tasmanians is, well, I think the fact that probably sums it up better than anything for Tasmanians is that there are four Tasmanians that are legends of the AFL. Now, that's pretty outstanding when you compare Western Australia, South Australia to Tasmania and Victoria. It's a pretty fair representation, isn't it?
And you're one of them. One last left field question that I've always wondered. How anyone who talks to you talks about you being the most beautiful, generous, gentlemanly man. How, given all your achievements across your football career, have you remained so humble?
Well, it's nice of you to say it. But it's a really difficult question to answer, because I don't think of myself as humble. But a lot of people say to me, one of the things that people say is that you've always got time for people. And I say, well, it's nice of you to say that. And I haven't set out in my life to achieve that. But I have a very strong feeling about people. If people want to talk to me about football, and this gets more important as the years go by, if they take the time to talk to me, I feel obliged to take the time to talk to them. And more often than not, if it's somebody I don't know and they come up and they say, oh, you know, I remember you back in such and such a day, and I came into your hotel or something like that, at the end of the conversation, I'll always say, well, you know, thanks for saying hello, because they don't have to do that. And it makes you feel good, and there's no doubt about that. You wouldn't be human if you didn't appreciate the fact that people acknowledge the fact that they know you. That's just part of life. And so that's how I feel. And I don't feel like, you know, I know that a lot of people know who I am. And, you know, once again, that's not being egotistical, it's just a fact of life. But I don't think of it in any other terms than, you know, I was lucky to play football. I was lucky to be able to do what I did in football. I appreciate that. But at the end of the day, I'm still me, and I'm still Stephanie's husband. I'm still Perry and Paul's father. And I've got 7 grandchildren. So I reckon I'm pretty lucky.
Peter Hudson, genuine, humble, a giant of Australian rules football, one of Tasmania's finest and most revered. If you enjoyed this episode of The Heart of It, make sure to like and subscribe to the podcast. I'm Alistair Nicholson. Thanks for listening.